What an incredible pleasure to have with us Michael Morpurgo today, the extraordinarily well-known playwright, poet, author, best known for so many things, but including War Horse. And he's been Children's Laureate, been president of the Book Trust, which is Children's Reading Charity. And today we're going to be talking about reading, the decline of reading, why reading matters. We're going to look a bit at films of Michael's books and how can a film ever be as good as a book. We're looking at Michael's own writing and how he got into it, and then at education, and then very importantly about nature and why to young people experiencing nature and farms in particular matter, and the extraordinary charity that Michael with his wife Claire have set up, which is Farms for City Children. And just about that on this celebratory 50th anniversary year. But Michael, let's begin with reading. What was the first book that you read, or the first author that really got through to you, and why?
I think the first author that really got through to me is not the first author whose name I recognized. I was brought up on an illicit book.
Michael, I expected that.
Well, it's illicit in a strange way. My school, little prep school in little Sussex, dreadful place, that doesn't matter. But what does matter is they and my home banned one author, and that was Enid Blyton. Do not ask me why, but I think what it was probably that to read the Enid Blyton book for me as a very young child was, in a sense, like opening a box of chocolates. You just wanted to go on and on and on and turn the page and turn the page and turn the page. And until you had finished it, it was everything. And then you would read another one, and then you'd read the one you just read. So I'd go to Smuggler's Top or whatever it was. I did that a lot, illicitly, as I say, under the blankets with a torch in my prep school, and quietly on my own at home, and didn't tell people. It was my sort of big sin. And I got caught at school and punished for it.
Quite rightly, Michael. I mean, it was shocking. I'm just surprised that you're so shameless, you are willing to share that terrible truth with us.
Terrible truth. It's an interesting truth, because the good thing about Enid Blyton was that I associated books very, very early on through that, and through my mother reading to me, to be fair. That was a big... She read me, you know, Masefield, Delamere, Kipling, all these people. And she was an actor. And so she read beautifully, and I loved her. And to have the person that you love most in the world reading to, that was the serious passing on of a love of stories. But when I first came to read for myself, it was Enid Blyton. And it is true that if you read books like that, it gives you very, very quick satisfaction on page turning. It's great for longing for the next book. And that book's therefore something you like. And that's really important.
I'm going to ask, okay, yeah, before the bus. I get to ask, what was it about Enid Blyton? Let's assume it was some kind of snobbery from the point of view of the school about her writing, because I too loved Enid Blyton. Let's share our favourite Enid Blyton book. Go for it, Michael.
Well, it's all the five books. I mean, what I read, I think five Go to Smuggler's Top I read again and again and again. And I know what it is. I got to know those characters. They became my friends, essentially. And also, the other thing I have to say, I was a boy, and it was mostly boys. There was a girl in it, but she was called George. So it was all very, very strange, but it was adventurous. And he was adventurous, and you went somewhere, and so you did go to islands, and there were smugglers. And anyway, I just loved living the adventure. And that's what I learned to love in books, living the adventure But it was, and I know now, pretty superficial. It was, you turned the page and there was sort of another adventure, and on it went, and on it went. Well, first proper writer, the first real writer, great writer I ever met, was Robert Louis Stevenson.
How old were you at the time? By the way, Ring of Bells Mystery is the must-read Blyton book. How old were you when you got on to Robert Louis Stevenson?
I suppose I started being 10, and I got it out of my very musty school library. In terribly small print. Everything was in small print, and everything was musty. But it was Treasure Island. And that was the first time, without thinking about it, I didn't intellectualize it at all, but what I did realize was that these characters had something of the people I knew and of the possibilities. So the boy, Jim Hawkins, was roughly my age when he started out on this adventure. And what was wonderful about this book was for the first time, these characters were not predictable. I liked Long John Silver just as he did. I thought he was great until you suddenly realized Jim was in his barrel of apples and hearing this mutinous, murderous talk going on amongst the pirates, all led by this Long John Silver. And you suddenly realized that all this charm, all this chat was a cover. Well, that never happened in any Blyton books. Everyone was what they looked like in the pictures, if you want. And then there was the other thing he did wonderfully well. He was a wonderful artist in drawing landscape and what the landscape fed to the story and vice versa. So when you do go to the island, and I can see absolutely in my mind's eye as I'm speaking to you now, I can see the stockade and I could see the trees all around and I could see where the boat sailed in. And all that is in my head all these years later. And I'm still Jim Hawkins. And I think that's what it is, because he was so well drawn, this character. And he was, I didn't learn this till later, but of course, Robert Louis Stevenson was a phenomenal writer. Yes, he wrote great children's yarns. We also wrote dark adult novels. And he wrote books about travel, travels about donkeys, one of the great sort of animal travel books that there is. And he wrote poems, wonderful poems. So he was a truly great writer. He's still, along with Ted Hughes, they're my two mentors in terms of writing. So I found a mentor really quite young, at the age of 10, who I can't imitate him, but I've tried to rise to the level at which he used words to paint pictures of people and places and feelings.
You obviously could never have met Robert Louis Stevenson, but you did a deep beat and knew Hughes very well. We'll come on to that. But let's keep with children's stories. And why is it important? And why does it matter? Evidence from America that in the previous year, 70% of Americans didn't open a book. I don't know what comparable figure for the UK is, but why does reading matter? Is it essential or is it a nice to have for a child? And does it have to be in on paper, Michael, or could it be on a screen?
I mean, first of all, it's not an add-on. It's essential. It's absolutely essential to a child's growing. Because it's a pathway towards discovery of the world about them, of themselves, and to do it in a way which is in their own time. In other words, no one's showing them a picture. They're doing it themselves. This is this wonderful intellectual link between yourself and someone who wrote this story. It doesn't matter what the name is, it doesn't matter who she or he is. It's the story. And you lose yourself in the words and in the pictures this person has made, and you make it your own. That's the point. You have to make a mental effort to be inside this story. And if the story invites you in a way that works, then you want to read that writer again and again and again. I think that's what it is. It's this business of engaging deeply, not in a frivolous way. I mean, the problem with when pictures are great, films are great, theatres great, don't get me wrong, but Shakespeare was wrong. The play is not the thing. It was a decent nine in Shakespeare, but the play is one of the things. It's a great thing. But it is there for you. You know, it's on the stage. People are costumed up. these days there's lighting, there's sound, all this sort of stuff. And you respond to it, it's fine. But a book is really just you. You're the person at the center of the story. So you do the traveling all around the world. You discover, if you're 10 years old, you discover what it's like to do 80. If you're a boy, you discover what it's like to be a girl. All this sort of thing. Each book is a voyage, if it's any good, of discovery. And that is wonderful. It means that your knowledge grows, whether it's fiction or non-fiction, it grows. As you travel in these books, it grows and grows. Your understanding of yourself and big relationships, it's absolutely critical, I think, to the way children grow up. And by and large, we are, in our little lives, limited to our family, and you know, maybe going around a holiday once or twice a year and school. That's fine. But it is great for children to know there's another world out there, a bigger world, an imaginary world, a future world, definitely a past world. And the more that you learn about the past, where we come from, who we are, and the more you can understand the world about you. And if you think children are being brought up now, they don't necessarily sit down and watch the news. But my goodness, it happens in front of them on their phones, on their iPhones. They see all these images of this, that, or the other. You might see a picture of the Gaza being bombed or some awful happening somewhere else. You have to have some idea of the why and the whatever. Why is this happening? And it's commutated. It's complex, grown up people. The children very, very slowly have to begin to understand that this is a complex world. And at home, inside your home, just down the street, in your school, people are complex. And books really help you grasp that. And they help you grasp also your place in the world, you know? And to find your own voice, that's the next and almost the most important thing. It helps children to feel that they too have stories to tell. They too can write down their poems. That, yes, brilliant people do. We have our Ted Hughes, we have our Shakespeare, we have these Philip Pullman, wonderful, wonderful people. But you've got something to say. And it's your view of the world that you are learning. And no one else, not a single person at all, in all humanity, has ever seen the world exactly like you do. And I think that's a wonderful discovery to make. So that when you do write, start telling your story down onto the page, it matters. It matters to you. It may not matter to other people. It matters to you. And I think that's very important, that your words matter. It gives you self-worth. And self-worth, I think, is probably one of the most important ingredients of a great education, is you find out you're okay. And it's in common parlance, you find out you could do stuff.
Right. So, this is Good Be Listened To, Michael, by Wellington College, Wellington, the Wellington family and beyond. Primarily parents, but not exclusively, in this country and globally. Authors or particular books would you recommend that they should be themselves advocating for their children? I mean, I'm going to ask you here for a list of, say, 5 or 10. What immediately comes to mind that every child should ideally read themselves?
Well, it's very difficult because to make a list out of your head isn't easy, but I have to say what I like. But yeah, it's all I came through, and not what other people should. I mean, the great writers of today are coming on. You know, we do have Philip Pullman, of course, but we also have the new, if you like, Catherine Rundell, all these extraordinary people who have been in children's books some time. And I think, you know, we have children's laureates going way, way back, whether it's Jacqueline Wilson or Anne Fye or David Arman. David Arman is a great writer, but nearly so well known as he should be. He wrote a book called Skellig, which is one of the great works of modern children's literature. But there are the great poets too. There's Heaney, there's Hughes. Why they should all begin with H, I don't know. But I suppose I'm fairly broad in my suggestions, but I think the most important thing for parents is probably that they have to like the book that they recommend. I mean, I suppose the tale I want to tell about parents is the most important tale there is to tell about how you pass on reading. Because, well, let me give you an example. I was on a beach in Normandy about 18 months ago with my family. I've got a sort of half-French family. And Normandy it was. And sitting on the beach in front of me, I was sitting on the beach in a deck chair because they're very kindly now, and the grandfather or great-grandfather, they provide me with a deck chair. So I was sitting there just watching. And my, I don't know what you call it, my sort of grandson-in-law, this huge Norman man of about 6'5", and he was sitting there in his bathing costume, facing the sea away from me, but slightly so that I could see the side of him. And sitting on his lap in his bathing costume was this child, my great-grandson, of less than 1 year old. And on the beach in Normandy, there was a book open on the child's legs, and the father was reaching over and turning the pages and reading the story. And I was thinking to myself, this is how the thing really starts. Because the association of this voice that you know and trust and love, and the book or the pictures in this case that you're seeing, and the turning of the page and the feel of the page, and the sound of your parent's voice. You could even feel the voice against your back as he was reading. And you could see what was really interesting was that the father was trying to turn the pages. Well, the child wasn't having any of it. Two or three pages were turned, and of course he wanted to turn back and see what he just see. And it's this early discovery that a book is something to be enjoyed.
And if you were education secretary, Michael, and I wish that you would be, what are the things that you would do to get a really nourishing, creative, extraordinary, joyful school system?
I think the first thing, and I would stick with the reading, because it is quite important, that one of the most important things to get right is the training in teachers. It doesn't work if you haven't trained them properly. And the most important thing when it comes to books and reading is that teachers love the books themselves. If that's what happens, it doesn't actually matter how well you read it. I'm going to give you an example. I went to King's College London when I was an older sort of person. And there was a wonderful professor there called Garmondsway, who was not a great communicator. But he sat on a desk, was on the corner of the desk in his Donegal tweed suit. Can you imagine puffing a pipe? And read Beowulf in its original language. And we all sat there 20, 30 hours. And you listened. You listened because you knew in his words that this man meant it. And this thing of teacher meaning it and loving it himself really, really matters. Whether you are 5 or 6 or whether you are 18 or 19 or 20, that matters. And if you can get that right, the training of teachers, that's really, really key. Plus, in this absurd world we live in, where teachers like are constrained by Ofsted and a sort of regime of what you have to learn, what must be taught, and this exam at the end of it, reading doesn't fit into that. There's no exam you can take at the end of reading a poem by Heaney or Hughes, any of these people. What matters is whether those words resonate with you. If not academically later on, of course that matters. But to start with, what matters is you just want to hear more of the poetry, or you want to hear it again. And that is critical. The whole business of making it a joy and continuing the joy and giving space in the time of the day. And what happens now, teachers time and time again say to me, we can't do the reading of stories as we used to, because the outcomes are not evident. And I'm thinking, outcomes? This is for life. Education for life. It's not for passing an exam in 2.5 years' time. That's been the problem right the way through. And I think every single primary school in the country, every single one, should have in their heads as a head teacher and the teachers that from 3 o'clock or 3, every school in the country is silent, except for a teacher reading or the children writing.
I very love that, Michael. And part of our human flourishing work at Wellington that you're involved in is exactly to that. It's how to embed reading for precisely the reasons you say. And I want to just look now at the films, though, of your own books. And can a film of a novel, and talking particularly here about your own writing, can a film ever do justice to the artist's creativity? And looking, I suppose, most obviously at the Spielberg War Horse, was that different? Was it a different artistic product? Can young people just see the film and then not read the book? Tell us how you feel about it.
I think the first thing to say is that I'm very grateful to Steven Spielberg, because when you have a film made by him, the result of it is that millions of people read the book. So that isn't just good for a writer's ego, it's quite good for a writer's pocket. But the important thing about it is that the book gets read. And then the interesting thing, and I'll just take you briefly through the whole journey of Walls was, when it was published, I think it sold under 800 copies, and it was only put into paperback about 5 years later. It sat on people's shelves collecting dust for more than 20, 25 years, until Mutz Spielberg of the National Theatre came along. Tom Morris there decided he wanted to make a play using wonderful puppets, hand-string puppets they were bought. He'd worked with them before, and he wanted to work with them again. And he went to Mick Heitner and said, look, I found this story, but my mother read it to me. Gave me a copy of this book, I think we've got the beginnings of something. And I know these people who make life-size puppets, it could be something wonderful. And Nick Heitner, bless his heart, Tom Morris got together, and for 2 years they workshopped and workshopped. This is what is wonderful. When theatre is supported by the state, it can do that. It can take time, and they took time. 2 years they brought in the best designers and people like Ray Smith, and wonderful composers, and they brought everyone in together, and they created the most extraordinary play. The play was a genius one. It was absolutely extraordinary. Not like the book. There were things in that they cut out from the book, but I didn't mind, because what they created finally was a play with enormous integrity. What happened was that the Spielberg's producers saw the play in London, and it called Kathy Kennedy. And she was delighted by it, loved it, rang him up instantly, and he came over excited, saw the play, was entranced by it, and made the film. The film was huge, and went all around the world, and suddenly the book, instead of not selling a copy or two, was a bestseller, 25 years later. Well, great, I'm most grateful to it. But in terms of the film, there were wonderful moments in it. It's Long in the Souls, to me, that's got great moments, extraordinary moments. Cavalry rises up in the cornfield and rides through the cornfield. It's quite extraordinary. The war scenes are extraordinary. But I do, every time I see it, find it's not fault. It's just a disappointment that it wasn't constantly connected to the place, because the place is really important. The place is where I'm speaking to you from, in the middle of Devon. And in 1914, when those young men went off to war from all over Europe, they went from this village too. And when the church bell rang and the army came to the village, Green bought the horses. Young farmer boy's horse in my head was sold away to the army. And the whole story is about the boy going off and finding his horse. Well, the war bit, he did wonderfully well. But here, at the time, people's lives here were hard and difficult. And they really died quite young. They exhausted themselves. It's a really hard life. And to paint a picture of it being a bit rosy, I didn't care for it. It seemed to me they were, it was a bit John Ford. There were too many beep sunsets and stuff like that. And they didn't plow as they should have. I know it sounds petty, but when you see a horse plowing up and down a hill, and you know that's not the way to plow, you think, well, you've got the war seats right, and it was great. Why can't you plow a field, right? So there were things like that. And once you lose confidence in a film, it's very difficult to go on with it. But I had a film made recently to show that how wonderful it is, when it's really great, which is a film called Kinski's Kingdom, which is on BBC iPlayer in the moment. And Kinski's Kingdom took 22 years to make. War Horse took 2 years. 22 years, it's an animated full-length feature film. But unbelievably well and carefully and lovingly drawn and made. And there the aspect of the book, which is finally about the relationship between a boy, a suburban boy, falling off his parents' yacht with his dog in the middle of a coral sea and swimming and finding himself on an island, thinking he's isolated, and discovering that on this island there is this Japanese ancient warrior left behind from the Second World War. And the whole story is about the relationship between this ancient man well into his late 80s and this young boy who then has to learn what this Japanese soldier has learned, how you live alone, how you live with nature, and then they have to learn how to live with each other. And I wish they'd made the film before I wrote the book, because I'd have written a better book. It's different, it's a film. So it's not exactly the same, and it never will be. And I think that's, in a way, what's important. You have to think of a film as being different, a play being different. And what you want is, in its new form, you want it to really touch your heart in the way I hope that the book does. And Kinski's Kingdom did that, and The Paths of Warbles did that. And I love the people who make films too, the people who immerse themselves in. Imagine immersing yourself in a story for 22 years. There were 65 people drawing Kinski's Kingdom. And the extraordinary thing was they did it in lockdown, sitting in their little rooms, doing drawings and drawings and drawings. And it all joined up together. And I love the magic of that. There was a magic in the making of it and a magic in the film.
I got to ask you there about just an extraordinary moment of your life and its connectedness with the film of, I think, David Lean, of when you were watching Great Expectations on television in about 1962, and what your mother said.
Yes, that was rather strange. It wasn't David Lean. It wasn't that version. It was the Trevelyan Broadcasting Company. And it was on BBC, and I think it was Christmas time, I think, when I was really quite young. And I came from a family where there was, like a lot of families after the Second World War, the divorce rate went up by 4 times, I think, and my family was one of them. Well, a casualty of the war, really, my family, I suppose it was. And anyway, I didn't know my father at all. He left when I was 2 and went off in the end to live in Canada and had another family over here, and I didn't see him. So it happened, I think, to an awful lot of people. I didn't miss him. I had a stepfather. But I was interested in him. And my brother, Peter, used to get magazines, and we'd see pictures of him sometime. And I knew he was an actor, but that's all I really knew about him. And we weren't allowed to talk about him. My name is not Morpurgo. My name is really Bridge. And we were never allowed to mention the word Bridge or Tony. Tony Bridge was his name, because it upset my stepfather and made him cross, and my mother did not make him cross. And we never asked questions, but we did ask questions, which he wouldn't answer. Anyway, we're sitting watching Great Expectations. Yes, 1962. And it was, as you know, black and white in those days, and only 2 channels. And my stepfather rationed television. And you're only allowed to watch television if he said you could. 1962, I mean, I think it was Easter or Christmas, I can't remember, but the whole family in those 2 used to gather around the television because it was relatively new. Black and white. And we were allowed to watch because my stepfather said we could. And it was a series of, well, actually, it was a film of Great Expectations. And I knew the story a little bit. Most people know the beginning of it almost better than anything else. And the beginning, of course, is when young Pitt, on the east coast of England, and it's dark and gloomy, and he's going on a shortcut through a graveyard to get home. And he's passing by these gravestones, and we're all sitting watching it, and it was tense, tense, tense. And then suddenly up from behind one of the gravestones reared this hideous figure. And my mother, who was sitting next to me, grabbed me by the leg and said, "Oh, Michael, that's Tony. That's your father." And so the first time I ever saw my father, he was Magwitch in Great Expectations. And I remember half the family walked out. It was that sensitive, but I didn't, and my brother didn't, and actually my mother didn't. We all 3 sat there and watched the film all the way through. It was a moment, really, of, you know, we're going to watch this. This is our father, and we want to watch it. It was a sort of statement of staying there. Darnaud Forgotten. I'd actually known him quite well later on. I got lucky because he was still acting when he was in his 80s out in Canada. Niagara-on-the-Lake Festival, Shaw Festival. And I went to see him. On the last play I ever saw him in, he had very little memory left, poor Tony. He was, so he couldn't remember in the morning where the cornflakes were in the kitchen. But he got on that stage and he had a monologue of an Arthur Conan Doyle play about the last surviving soldier from the Battle of Waterloo. And he sat there in his chair in his slippers and delivered, at the age of 84, a monologue, word perfect. And I remember all the audience got up and clapped at the end, but not before I did. It was a wonderful moment.
It's a wonderful story, Michael. Extraordinary. Bringing things to a close now, and as a segue through to the Farms for City Children, just to, I was thinking about your image there of the plough from Warhorse, and thinking of Thomas Hardy and plows on farms, but also your relationship with Ted Hughes, and which was formative for both of you. Could you just say a word about that?
Yes, of course. We happened to have as a neighbour. I met him down by the river one day, and 50 years ago almost, when I was just walking along, and he surprised me. He loomed up from under a riverbank, River Torridge, with his fishing rod in his hand, and he said, hello, and quite a Yorkshire accent. I said, I know your work. I remember Wind very well. He said, oh, I like Wind too. I remember that. So we had a little conversation, and it was a wonderfully happy coincidence because he grew up in a town in Yorkshire, but he spent his best childhood moments not in the town at all, but wandering the moors high above the town. And he's said again and again to me how that sowed the seed corn of everything he'd done in his life. That's where he came to know nature, watching it, feeling part of it. And this business about feeling part of it is what he passed on to us. It wasn't just a manner of teaching. This was fulfilling, if you like, what it is that we should have, which was a sense of belonging to nature. And so he was a magnificent support to us all the way through the first 25 years of the charity, until certainly he died far too young. We deliberately focused on the children who were little. And we knew what they were missing, because she had discovered when she was little how wonderful it was to walk in this countryside where I'm speaking to you from, in the middle of Devon. And when she was a teacher, well, she and I realized pretty soon that in front of every class that we stood to teach, half the children came from homes where people talked, where they read books, where they had an interesting life outside school, but half didn't. And the half that didn't, we didn't feel making any real progress at school at all. So in other words, what we were doing was passing on the status quo. We both decided to pass on to children how it was to be in the countryside, which is theirs as much as anyone. They just don't see. That was important too, that they discovered where their food came from. So they don't come down the clipboard and just tick things off. They come here for a week and they live and they work on the land, and they do it with proper farmers. So yes, they will feed the pigs, they will milk the cows, they'll move the sheep, they'll feed the sheep, they'll dig in the vegetable garden, plant vegetables, pick berries, all that. They do all the things that country people and country children do, yes, with all the bounds of safety. So this is what aren't now for 50 years, and we're celebrating our 50th year this year since the first children, and it, literally it's 2 weeks ago, 50 years ago, the first children from Birmingham walked up the drive in their wellies from an estate on the edge of Birmingham, and they began their week of wonder, their week on the wild side, which they'd never forgotten. And I say that with confidence, because I meet them now. I go to book festivals and events, and people come up to me and want their book signed or something, and I look up and there's this tall man, 6'3", and saying, I remember you, sir. We marked out a calf shed together 40 years ago or something like that. And I think a week on the farm here is like a great book. Actually, a book can change you. A film can change you. Great film, a great book, a great play. Yes, it can change you. It can set you on a path that you want to follow. And a week on the farm can do the same thing, particularly when it comes to nature and opening your eyes to this world, which is theirs.
You and Claire have changed the lives of tens, hundreds of thousands, millions of lives for the better. And spending this 50 minutes in your company has been a deep privilege. Michael Morpurgo and Claire, thank you from all of us. And
Forever Rhapsody, thank you so much. Bless your heart. Bye-bye.